News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In 1990, 1 in 12 Americans was an immigrant. By 2005, it was 1 in 8. And these days, new arrivals aren't just choosing big cities like New York or Los Angeles. They're heading for smaller communities like Manchester, Concord, or Nashua, New Hampshire. Overall, the Granite State's foreign-born population grew by 26% from the year 2000 to 2008. And with these demographic changes comes new opportunities and new challenges. One of those is how new arrivals interact with our health care system, a system already under stress from financial pressures, staff shortages, and a perpetual time crunch. Health providers now find themselves working with interpreters and navigating new cultural waters where a simple miscommunication can literally mean life or death if it leads to a mistake in treatment. Still, since the 1990s, more Granite Staters are getting involved in these issues, from state agencies to nonprofits to medical staff. Today in The Exchange, as we continue our series on New Hampshire's immigration story, we look at how new arrivals interact with the healthcare system, and let's hear from you, too. If you've recently moved here from another country, what's your experience been with healthcare? If you work in this field, what are the particular issues that come up for you? Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests who've been working on this issue for a long time. Dr. Paula Mayen. She practices at the Westside Neighborhood Health Center at Catholic Medical Center. She's been treating immigrants and refugees in Manchester since 1994. And Dr. Mayen, thanks for taking the time. We know you're busy.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Dr. Trinidad Tellez, Director of the Office of Minority Health and Refugee Affairs at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Tellez, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Also with us, Kelly LaFlamme, Program Director at the Endowment for Health. She manages initiatives on social and cultural barriers to health. And Kelly, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Kelly, and to all of you, managing the healthcare system can be frustrating enough, you know, for somebody who's lived here their whole lives. It's co-pays, deductibles, preferred providers and so forth. Kelly, just give us a sense of what it can be like for someone who just got here from another country who may not speak English at all.
Well, I think it really depends on where a person is coming from. But many of the newcomers that we have coming into New Hampshire really don't have experience with the complicated Western medicine that we have here in the U.S. And if they did have access to health care, they may not have had situations where they had to make appointments ahead of time and show up at a specific time. Perhaps they would walk to a clinic and wait their turn and just sort of have a different experience. And so for some of our newcomers that are from less developed communities than the ones that we live in, this is a whole new ballgame for them. And then for some of our other newcomers who are from Europe and other places, they're kind of disappointed by the healthcare system that they receive here. I met a woman once from Spain who said, you know, I've moved here and made my life here, but I'm not bringing my mother here. I need to make sure that she has access to healthcare so she has a well life. So I think it really varies.
Well, when someone comes in and they don't have coverage, let's say they're a refugee from, Burundi or Somalia, how do they even get healthcare? I mean, are they covered by Medicaid?
When refugees first arrive, yes, they are covered by Medicaid for a certain amount of time. And I'll let Dr. Tellez give us the specifics on refugee resettlement. And immigrants who are here, who come in, for economic reasons or family reasons, they do not have access to Medicaid for 5 years. After welfare reform was passed, the five-year bar was created that keeps even immigrants who are here with documentation, they keeps them away from services funded by the federal government, like Medicaid, for 5 years.
Dr. Tellez, I love your broad thoughts, too, on just, anybody who's gone through their insurance forms when they switch insurance companies knows it's tough to navigate the system. Again, your broad thoughts on what you've seen in terms of people trying to figure this out when they get here.
Well, as someone who tried to figure out Medicare for my mother, you know, as someone with an advanced degree and trying to deal with insurance agencies and reading books, I think it's hard for everybody to understand, let alone people with language barriers or maybe different levels of education or coming from very different systems. So I would agree with what's been said. The question about the refugees who come, they do get Medicaid, but depending upon their individual circumstances, that may only be for 8 months or it may be for longer. My history is as a family physician who has always practiced in community health centers. And so the mission of community health centers is to serve people regardless of their ability to pay. And so while community health centers oftentimes will have a large Medicaid population, they'll also take people on sliding fee scales and provide the care that's needed. So it makes it harder for some people to be able to maybe be served at, you know, maybe some of the places that your listeners go to, but certainly community health centers are more than just the place of last resort. They're actually oftentimes providing incredibly excellent care with people who are very passionate and motivated to serve in those kinds of settings because, you know, as physicians, most of us go into medicine because we really want to take care of people. And it's fulfilling and rewarding. And sometimes some of the physicians, like Dr. Mahan here, really thrive on being in a setting where they have exchanges and relationships with people from other cultures. So, yes, it's challenging. Fortunately, we do have the safety net system. That could be a whole other discussion, is what's going on with the safety net system. But I think in general, the complexities still exist with trying to understand, even if you can get to the doctor, there's all the other issues around access or around understanding how things work here.
Well, and let's turn to you, Dr. Mahan, again, practicing at Westside Neighborhood Health Center, working with immigrants and refugees in Manchester since the mid-90s. Give us some of your stories, Dr. Mahan, from your daily practice of how not growing up in American culture may change the way someone approaches healthcare.
In my clinic presently, there's a lot of hand-holding that happens. People come in under the guise of the International Institute's medical case manager, so they basically are driven to the appointment, and then I hope subsequently they choose to come back again after that. And since I'm in their neighborhood, Catholic Medical Center is right smack in the middle of the city, so it's easy for people to even walk to if they need stuff. In the earlier days, I remember people coming in just to get crackers and watch TV in the waiting room. It was fun. And then maybe they'd have a little question like, oh, what is this? And it might be a freckle or something. But I've also had people who've had incredibly difficult health conditions that have not seen Western medicine at all. And as one of my friends says, your practice is the practice of people with advanced conditions that have never seen Western med, and then you see the natural progression of a disease that's untouched by healthcare.
It must be incredibly frustrating too. Because, you know, gee, if I'd seen you 2 years ago, I might have been able to help you, but now I can't.
It's not, I don't think of it as frustrating. I think of it as, I'm so sorry that this went so long, but here's what I can do for you now. You know, and sometimes it might involve bracing or physical therapy, or I've now become an expert at writing letters to Social Security Disability and learning the words to document disability that is permanent and unfixable. And so then I just try to do the best I can to make it work for them so they can live in America or they can function some way, like by combing their hair or, you know, picking up a toothbrush or something like that if they've been burnt or if they've had congenital malformations that just can't be fixed now, you know.
You know, I wonder, you're a female doctor, Dr. May, and I wonder if there are any sort of male-female cultural taboos that you run up against.
Hardly ever. I've only, in all the years I've practiced, I've only had one not even a patient, maybe. It was the husband of a patient. And I said, "Hi, I'm Dr. Mayen." And I put out my hand to shake it. And he said, "No, no, he doesn't touch." But no, I haven't had any real cultural taboos at all. I don't know. I lived abroad. I lived in Kenya before I went into med school. So I think I got a really good cultural sensitivity training in that respect.
Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in the Exchange, we're continuing our series on New Hampshire's immigration story with a look at how the healthcare system is trying to adapt. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Tayes, I wonder from you, too, some examples of just how you didn't grow up in this culture, if you didn't grow up in this culture, how you may think about healthcare differently, how you may approach healthcare differently, how hard it must be to kind of put your mind on how things work in this country.
Well, I think Kelly made some excellent points about how there's a huge range of people's experiences that they bring, just as there's a huge range of experiences that people from this country have. So you could be from New York City, you could be from the Midwest, you could be from the South, and they will have huge, huge implications for maybe the way you view the world or the experiences you had with whatever system existed there. So I think that's a constant. The other thing is when we talk about immigrants, you know, while we don't want to overwhelm people with data, it is important to kind of get on the same page of what we're talking about. And I'm relatively new to my position. I've been there a year and a half, and getting a handle on what are the numbers, what's the magnitude of what we're talking about. New Hampshire is increasingly diverse, and I have from Ken Johnson, who's the senior demographer at the Kersey Institute, New Hampshire is now 7.7% minority, which means 93% non-Hispanic white. Everyone else is minority. So that's probably a lot more than people realize. And then I can explain a little bit further
after
about
a
immigrants.
Short break. Yeah. All right, great. And we will take your calls after a break, too. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network organizations partnering with New Hampshire colleges and universities in November to bring you I'm Going to College Month, nhcollegeclub.org. From the Flying Monkey, Plymouth, with the Leahy Family Christmas featuring soaring Celtic fiddles and harmonies with choreographed dancing December 1st. Tickets at flyingmonkeynh.com. And Lakes Region General Hospital in Laconia hosting a grand opening of its new patient care edition November 19th with tours, a wellness fair, health screenings, and more. Details at lrgh.org. More of our series on New Hampshire's immigration story with a look at the impact on our healthcare system on the Exchange on NHPR at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the looming worldwide diabetes epidemic. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy with some filtered sunshine with a chance of some passing sprinkles or a shower. Highs today 60 to 65 in most of the state, 55 in the North Country. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our series on New Hampshire's immigration story continues. We're examining how the healthcare system has been caring for growing numbers of immigrants and refugees in the Granite State. The law says health providers must ensure equal access for all. And when it comes to caring for new arrivals with limited or no English, that can involve hiring interpreters. Exchange executive producer Keith Shields spent some time with one such interpreter, helping patients navigate the system.
It's early morning at Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic's neurology department in Manchester, and a patient named Nora has come in. She complains of spasms on the right side of her face, as well as a numbness in her left arm.
And where is it on the arm?
¿Y dónde?
Is it the arm or the hand?
¿Es la mano o el brazo?
La todo, porque no puedo agarrar mucho porque siento que es débil.
The whole thing, because I can't pick up too much because I feel it weak.
Okay.
But Nora hardly speaks English. She's an immigrant from El Salvador. And that's where Alexandra Baer comes in. Alexandra is one of 130 interpreters employed by the New Hampshire Language Bank, part of Lutheran Social Services.
Can you close your eyes tight? Squeeze them shut. Nice and even stronger than that. Really tight. There you go.
For 10 years, Excellent. Bear has been interpreting for Spanish and Portuguese clients in New Hampshire. Over that time, she's been witness to the growth in demand for this service, not only because of a growing number of immigrants and refugees in the state, but also due to an increased awareness on the part of foreign-born Granite Staters that these services are available.
We have those people that speak no English whatsoever. We have those people that understand everything that is going on. They just feel more comfortable having an interpreter to make sure they understand 100% of the message. And we have those people that actually speaks the language, and it's for the benefit of the provider and for their own sake that they request to have an interpreter just to make sure that the patient is indeed understanding what the message is being put across.
The New Hampshire Language Bank has been in service for nearly a decade. Interpreters are available in over 60 languages, and before one can go out in the field, they need to go through an intensive training process that teaches them everything from short-term memory exercises to their strict code of ethics.
Confidentiality, that's number one. The other code of ethics is boundaries, maintain neutrality during the whole session. We're not supposed to advocate for the patient unless it's a life or death situation. And accuracy and completeness, all the elements of the message have to be transmitted to the patient or to the provider. And personal growth, obviously we know that medicine, it's a non-stop growing profession, and there's always going to be terms that are going to be coming up, new procedures, new medication, and we need to be up there with that. So we are familiar with them and we feel more comfortable as interpreters when we go to interpret at the hospital.
So I'm going to set up an electrical test for Monday to confirm this diagnosis.
Le voy a marcar un examen eléctrico para el lunes para confirmar este diagnóstico.
Basically, I'm putting electrodes on your fingers. I'm giving you some mild pulsations. It measures how fast the nerves are conducting electricity.
But there's more as well. New immigrants and refugees bring new beliefs that may not be understood by a health professional. Likewise, certain newcomers may not understand the culture of Western medicine. So who better to communicate those cultural misconceptions than a person who straddles both worlds? The interpreter. Alan Omer Begovic is the program manager for the Language Bank. He's a Bosnian interpreter as well as a refugee.
I went to interpret for a client who had an appointment in a local hospital. They were doing some testing to see if he has a cancer or not. He had no idea that that's what they were doing until I came there. All of his appointments before I came, his children were interpreting for him, and they were afraid to tell him that he has a cancer. Because in my culture, you know, cancer is someone you don't talk about, because it's almost, if you say you have a cancer, it's like you don't have a lot of time to live. It's like there's no treatment for it. So his children refused to interpret that for him. He had no idea.
There's other confusions as well. For example, hospitals may not understand the dietary concerns of Muslims or Hindus, or the fact that Somali Bantus who speak the Mai-Mai dialect may not want a person who translates in the national Somali language. So there's still admittedly a learning curve for all sides of this service, from the patient to the interpreter to those health professionals in New Hampshire who are treating more and more patients who don't speak English. Keith McAvoy is an attending neurologist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic and was the doctor who treated our patient Nora.
First of all, it slows you down a little bit. I have to speak, and then there's a pause for the interpreter to ask the question again, and then it has to go back to the interpreter and then relay back to me. So in general, it takes, you know, anywhere from 30 to 50% increased time to have a typical visit with a patient. The other issue is that I'm somewhat dependent upon the interpreter. So I'm asking a question. I have to hope that it's presented to the patient in the way that I'm presenting it to the interpreter. And then likewise, when the patient speaks back to me, I'm relying on the interpreter that the information that I'm getting is accurate information. So I think for the most part that works, but there's the possibility of some degree of miscommunication.
But despite the growing pains, the service continues to grow. In 10 years, the New Hampshire Language Bank has expanded from a few appointments a month to over 1,000. Each appointment means another teaching moment for all involved. And it's interpreters like Alexandra Bear who hope that over time they can be the ones that bridge the gap between doctors and patients, not only in language, but also in understanding and trust.
The majority of providers are getting to know more and more what our role is as an interpreter. But there are still some people in the medical field that still do not understand our role. And maybe they don't know why we do things the way we do. I feel that as I do my job, I'm also a teacher. And I'm also, you know, trying to put out there to providers and other people what we do. You know, so that's one of the major things is teaching the providers on, okay, this is what we do and this is the why.
Any other questions you can think of?
For the exchange, I'm Keith Shields.
Excellent. Okay, very good. Good seeing you again. All right, thank you. Thank you.
Again, today on The Exchange, our series on New Hampshire's immigration story continues. We're looking at how newcomers interact with our healthcare system. And let's hear from you. If you have moved here recently from another country, what has your experience been with our healthcare system? If you work in this field, what particular challenges or issues do you see coming up to figuring out healthcare for new arrivals? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, so many issues that came up in that piece that Keith brought us. And one that I'm particularly struck by, and I'll turn to you, I think, Dr. Mayen, the Bosnian interpreter saying, until I stepped in, my patient didn't even know he had cancer. What sort of issues come up when you have a professional interpreter versus a family member doing the work?
Oh, this is really important. And I've got egg all over my face for this one because I'm in the middle of something that bears this out. I love using family members. I think I learn a lot from the family members about the family and how things interact and, you know, all the stuff that I don't learn from the IOM paperwork that they come into country with from their refugee settlement camp. But sometimes when you have family members, they bring in their own baggage or their own interpretation of what's really going on. And right now I have a case where it's an older couple that was a secondary migration from the Midwest, and they came to New Hampshire because their niece's husband, so it's a little distant relation, is doing fantastically well as a refugee. Like, he figured out the system. He's got a great job now, and he did it very quickly within like a year of arriving in New Hampshire. And they wanted their elderly relatives to be in New Hampshire to get good health care, and also because they had had illnesses like a stroke and a subdural hematoma and diabetes, and they weren't well educated, they needed somebody to advocate for them. So this fellow brings in his distant relatives and says, his mother-in-law, but that's not really what it was, has dementia, and she's kind of crazy, and she wanders around, and she doesn't sit still at night or doesn't stay in bed, and I need some medicine for her, and she really needs to be on disability. And I asked questions, and he translated, and she really couldn't advocate for herself all that well, or so I thought from the interpreter. So, you know, fast forward, she's on SSI and she's got a guarantor for her SSI checks because she's not considered competent. And now her close relatives have come into town and they say, there's a family fight off in the distance.
Oh, dear. And you get involved in this. And
yes.
You're just trying to do your best job as a doctor.
Right,
but
exactly. And what happened is the closer relatives, the son came in, and now he's my patient, and he's got custody of his parents, and the guardianship is still with the distant relative. And the closer relative is saying, oh, no, they're not really all that bad. they really can think, and they don't wander around at night, and they're not.
Wow.
Well, and I'm like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, and here you are just trying to do the best. And Kelly, does this show us that perhaps it is best to use a professional in these situations?
No, I think so. I think Dr. Mann's story, as well as the story that Alan was telling, the importance of a professionally trained interpreter being involved in the medical experience, that a professional interpreter enables to create an environment where the doctor can do the job that he or she was trained to do in the way that he or she was trained to do it, not guessing or using gestures to try to figure something out. And The professional interpreter also allows family to be family. You know, pretty much all of my prenatal appointments, my husband went with me. Not because I don't understand what the doctor is saying, but because I wanted that support. I wanted him to be involved in my health care in the way that a husband should, not as a medical provider. So I think it's really important. I mean, we've heard horror stories of children having to deliver information to parents, young children, not adult children, but young children having to interpret in the case of a domestic violence case. Or, you know, these are not things that young children or adult children should be called upon to do. They can provide family context just like any other family member. But the professionalism of interpretation really is important. And that's why there's a movement across the country to have certification for professional interpretation.
Both, there isn't any certification right
not
now?
Not at this point. There's a national debate going on about exactly what that certification will look like. But there are minimum standards of training and preparation, code of ethics, things that trained interpreters understand medical language that, you know, the average person speaking an average language does not know the words for certain medical terminology.
Every discipline has its jargon.
Exactly.
So as I understand, Kelly, the medical interpreters program or programs here in New Hampshire have grown pretty rapidly in recent years, right?
Yeah. So, you know, the Endowment for Health, where I work, has been involved for about the last 10 years in helping to firm up the medical interpretation training programs. The Language Bank that we heard about earlier today is a former grantee of the Endowment for Health. So there are several statewide brokerages that are now existing in New Hampshire, as well as training programs that help to prepare people who are bilingual, bicultural, to be effective and professional interpreters.
And this relates to what you were doing just before the break, Dr. Tellez. You were starting to give us some numbers of where we're at in New Hampshire in terms of people who might need these services.
Right. So I was explaining New Hampshire's 7.7% minority, and that diversity has been increasing over time to more be like basically the rest of the country, which is much, much more diverse than we are here. It's also increasing from youngest to oldest, and it's geographically concentrated. So there are neighborhoods in Nashua and Manchester that are over 40% minority. Now, oftentimes what we do is we kind of confuse not everyone who's minority is an immigrant. And
right.
So the numbers that we get from Census or American Community Survey data tells us that the foreign-born, which is sort of the number to look at, is New Hampshire is about 5% foreign-born from the last data I could get, which was from 2008. And of that, only 6% are refugees. And yet, oftentimes when we talk about who's minority, we immediately think refugee, and it's such a small subset. And while I can't tell you exactly how the foreign-born overlaps, so the 5% New Hampshire is foreign-born, 7.7% is minority, there's a lot of overlap minority with foreign-born, but it's not absolute. But definitely all refugees are immigrants, and they're only 6% of the foreign-born we have. And so, you know, there is a you had a show yesterday on the history of immigrants in New Hampshire. You know, New Hampshire's foreign-born are actually very highly educated overall compared to the rest of the country, have higher earnings than foreign-born in the rest of the country. And so the kinds of things we're talking about, the challenges we're talking about, are really more about the challenges that people who maybe have less education or maybe have less earnings. So, yes, the refugees for sure, and immigrants who come who are not earning a lot of money. And so the challenges and barriers we've been talking about are people who have less education, have less income, and they're not universally applicable to all people who are foreign-born or immigrants necessarily. And I think that's an important clarification.
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes we use these words as shorthand, but it's good that you clarified that. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Mayen.
I interrupt and say, actually, the refugees are incredibly well-educated. The newest groups coming in are fantastically smart. The Iraqis have been to university. They're very highly trained. The Nepalis, a lot of them have been to university. They're actually doing very well negotiating everything that they have to negotiate. So I wanted to say, well, shout out to the refugees. They're not all undereducated.
Kelly.
In fact, most of them aren't.
And on that point, I think that, and I know I in the past may have been guilty of this, I think as Americans, we're not used to people speaking other languages around us. We're pretty, you know, everyone has to speak English. It's our country, speak English. And so I think we create a false perception that because someone's not fluent in English, they're not as smart as we are. But maybe they speak five other languages very well, thank you. And so I think your point is so well taken.
Did you want to jump in again, Dr. Tejas, on that?
No, I agree with that.
Okay. Our phone number again here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us an email, keep it short, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, one more question that came out of that piece that Keith did for you, Dr. Mayen. We heard from the doctor saying, it takes extra time to work with an interpreter. You know, I have to tell what I need to tell, and then the interpreter tells it, and then the patient responds, and there's just a lag time there. How do you find the extra time that it takes to analyze a patient who needs an interpreter?
First of all, I tend to do a lot of my appointments, if I can, in a group. So the whole family comes into the room if I can squeeze them all in. And that way I don't have to replicate the whole, you know, tell me about your family history, because I get it in one shot there. And similarly, I can, in follow-up appointments, say, oh, by the way, how's your mom's diabetes on the new med? Or I try to sort of bulk load everything. And I do the same thing with the interpreter. For example, I try to block schedule the patients. Some of my patients have found that not a good idea. They thought it was kind of like ghettoizing the clinic. But I think it's more economically sound. If I'm going to have to buy a translator, I might as well book them for 4 hours and then have like Bosnian day or Somali day or, you know, Liberian day or what, you know, well, Liberians speak English, but you know what I mean. Just sort of block schedule and then keep that interpreter literally at my hip like some kind of Siamese twin. And then they stay with me and then they don't lose. We don't use or lose time with interpreter transport between other offices and things like
waiting that. Waiting for someone to come in. All right, and we will take your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Today on Word of Mouth, all his children. A simple Google search reveals that a prolific cryobank donor is responsible for many pregnancies. What happens when the hot commodities of looks and brains meets the age when everybody has a blog? Plus, Awesomator Brady Carlson on bombastic campaign videos and flying rhinos. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth witnesses the impossible. Today at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AutoBeef, a website providing information for vehicle owners about squeaks, bangs, flashing lights, odd smells, and other vehicle complaints online at carcomplaints.com. And from Tupelo Music Hall, presenting Judy Collins in concert on November 26th in White River Junction. Tickets are available at tupelohall.com. The Londonderry show has sold out. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our series on New Hampshire's immigration story continues with a look at the challenges around public education. Email us your questions or experiences before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at how some newcomers interact with New Hampshire's healthcare system. And let's hear from you now. If you've recently come to New Hampshire from another country, what's been your experience with healthcare? If you're a healthcare provider or you work in this field in another capacity, what issues do you see coming up day to day to figuring out healthcare for newcomers, especially those with financial or language challenges? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, before the break, Dr. Mayen was talking about how she, as a health provider, tries to deal with the time pressure to see lots of patients, but the extra time that it takes to analyze a patient who does need an interpreter. And Dr. Tejas, you wanted to jump in there, so go ahead, please.
Well, the question was raised about physicians or providers thinking it's more burdensome to have to deal with an interpreter because there's a time cost. And I would actually maybe counter that a little bit with the realization that having an interpreter is actually essential to being able to provide quality care. And our goal as a healthcare system is to provide the highest quality care as possible. The Institute of Medicine has defined that there's six dimensions of quality, and those are that care be safe, that it be effective, that it be patient-centered, that it be timely, efficient, and equitable. And so you may have a system where an individual provider thinks they're doing a great job, but in reality, none of their patients understand, in English even, none of their patients understand what they're supposed to do when they go home. You know, we know that only 30% of medicines are taken correctly. That's by everybody. So when you add the dimension of, okay, there's a language barrier that's not being addressed that should be, you know, that the language access is not being provided, I think that it's short-sighted to think that an interpreter is not going to help, because while you may, you know, you think you're losing time, in reality, what you're increasing with increased understanding, increased adherence, and adherence is the word we use now rather than compliance, will have a much greater effect and benefit in terms of the quality that's delivered. And part of the reason I'm talking about quality now, I tend to take more of a systems level approach. So we've been talking a lot about the individual patient interaction, but as a system, you know, we know that America has the greatest healthcare system in the world, and yet our outcomes are pretty miserable compared to the rest of the world as a whole, as a population whole. And so if you talk about minorities or immigrants specifically, there are what are called health disparities, which basically means there are differences in health status based solely on the fact that your income level may be different, or the color of your skin may be different, or the language you speak may be different. And so these disparities have huge costs to society, and they're avoidable. And sort of socially, morally, ethically, we would say it's probably bad that we have differences that exist, that are pervasive and that persist, even when you control for socioeconomic status and other variables. And so when you think about trying to improve a system in its capacity to deliver high quality health care, pretty much every single national organization that is focused on quality, like Joint Commission, which credits hospitals, or the Institute of Medicine, or a whole other set of bodies, NCQA, everybody has recognized that cultural competence and the capacity, or cultural effectiveness, the capacity of systems to be culturally competent, to provide language access, is a very, very important component of being able to increase the quality of care that's delivered.
Well, and speaking of the quality of care, as you said, Dr. Tejas, you know, we are debating health in this country right now, how we can get more folks access to care, lower the cost for everybody. Lots of debate about the best way to do that. But a question for you, I think, Kelly LaFlamme, is, you know, lots of American citizens are struggling with this issue. So the question sometimes comes up, how much are the services that we're talking about for new arrivals to the Granite State take away from poor folks who've been here for a long time and who are also having these struggles?
Yeah, I think the system as a whole struggles to meet the needs of all vulnerable populations, whether it's folks who suffer from extreme chronic diseases that require a lot of resources to deal with, to help patients live the best life possible. And I think that, you know, we want to make sure that everyone in our community is living their lives the way that they can the most healthy, because it's really a public health issue. If, you know, newcomers don't live in complete isolation. You know, they live in our communities. Their kids attend our schools. And so it's really a case where if we're denying care from someone, the ERs can't turn someone away when they reach that most critical, most costly stage of a disease or of an illness. So why wait? You know, we really should be thinking in a more preventative way of ensuring that we all have, as Dr. Taya said, the opportunity to live the most healthy lives possible.
What do you think? I know you want to jump in here, Dr. Taya, and I'd love to hear from you too, Dr. Mayen. Are there sort of Is there an argument that, gosh, the more we provide these services for newcomers, we may be taking away from citizens who've been here their whole lives? I'm asking that question.
No, I don't think so at all. I think that in reality, as we were sharing at the beginning, the healthcare system is complicated and complex. It's difficult to understand. It's difficult to navigate, even for those of us who've been here umpteen generations and very highly educated. Making something more accessible as a system, making something more understandable, making something that's more patient-centered, making it so that all individuals understand how to take their medicines correctly for the full length of time, which is not something we have yet, making it so that all people get quality diabetes care. There are certain diseases like diabetes, chronic conditions, that have a very clearly well-demarcated set of guidelines for what needs to happen, both in processes and outcomes, for saying someone is getting the best care they could have. And as a country, we get that 50% of the time in the best case scenarios. So as systems, even for highly literate, highly completely English speaking people, we have so far to go when it comes to raising quality of our health system overall, that what we're realizing is that focused efforts to increase quality for some increases the capacity of the system overall to better serve everyone. So no one is ever insulted because something is too understandable. So thinking about the fact that something could be explained in a better way, either in writing or in person, using other kinds of materials, because all of us are different kinds of learners, you know, take the example of the shared decision making and prostate cancer screening counseling. That's a very complicated thing for everybody. And then, you know, try to think about how do you make that understandable to someone who may have a very different sort of cultural framework for how they understand health or their values, whether they're from this country or not. So,
you know, something else that came up, and then we will go to some calls. Dr. Mayen, I'll ask you, what do you do when someone comes to you for health care and they, you know, may face some of the challenges that we've talked about this hour, and it becomes clear to you that they really need mental health services, you know, been through trauma, getting here, or if they're a refugee, you know, escaping war and persecution? What do you do for them? Is there a place where you can say, you need mental health services, you can go here?
Yes. First of all, I sometimes can recognize the patient needs mental health before the patient recognizes they need mental health, although I'm lucky when the patient recognizes it first. And what I do is I normalize the experience. I say, listen, you've just been through hell. You just saw your parents shot in front of you. Your sister's been raped. You know, your kid's been beheaded. I mean, horrible, horrible things have happened. You would be absolutely within your rights to have a meltdown. So if you think you would like some help with your meltdown, and then I offer them services. I'm so lucky. I got a grant, or Paul Mertzik, who's my manager, got a grant at Westside Neighborhood Health Center. I have a nurse practitioner who's a psychiatric nurse practitioner, so she can provide meds. She works with me. We have a very close relationship, so I can refer people from my clinic directly there. But prior to having this grant, I first normalized the experience as much as possible to make it less stigmatizing. And then I might offer them some meds, give them a referral to either Manchester Mental Health or the psychiatric outpatient department at Catholic Medical Center would see them. And from there, you know, let them go to town.
Right. All right. Well, let's take some calls. And Rashida's calling from Manchester. Hi, Rashida. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. And I had the privilege to work with Dr. Bob Mahon and Kelly, and saying hi to both of them. My question or my comment is that the victims of domestic violence and how we train the professional healthcare providers to see the signs of abuse with their patients and try to, when they have their partners in the room or their children, to get them out so the victims will be comfortably talking and getting the resource. How we help them and how we can train the professionals to see the signs on with those women. And I say women because the majority of victims are women.
So that's tricky, Rashida. Thank you very much. Do you want to jump in on that, Dr. Mann?
Oh, I probably am not very good at recognizing things, and Rashida is probably the most helpful person to cluing me into recognizing these problems. Usually, I also try to have a good relationship with social workers in the community and in the hospital. And you're right. Sometimes I find out about these domestic violence cases after the police have been involved, so I'm probably a little slow and late. And probably also, unfortunately, kids are in the room by the time I hear about it. So, but I do try to have really open lines of communication with other providers of social services and try to expedite whatever things might be necessary to help in those situations.
Kelly?
It's great to hear from Rashida. She's been really helpful in educating me about the challenges in dealing with domestic violence issues, particularly in some of the African communities. And I think it's really important to have for providers and for policymakers to have connections with people like Rashida, who, as we had said earlier, walk in both worlds and understand how culture perceives some of these issues. And, you know, I don't have a great background in domestic violence, but, you know, I do understand that in the U.S. we have a perception that we want to ensure that the woman's safe and we have safe houses to bring people to. But in some cultures, that could really be the worst thing you could do, is to pull someone out of the family situation and take them out of their the community in which and community bonds. And so I think it's really important that we you know, work together with ethnic leaders to understand how these issues play out in their communities and come up with creative solutions rather than expect that these issues will just fit into the way that we've always done things here in our country.
Yeah, right. You know, Dr. Tay, as we've been talking about this health issue on more an individual level, when a person who's a new arrival has some problems and goes to seek care, goes perhaps to Dr. Paula Mahon's clinic. But what about public health issues? You touched on this earlier, but I'd love some more from you, Dr. Tayez. What comes up in terms of New Hampshire public health issues when we talk about making the system available, accessible to newcomers who have, you know, special challenges?
A lot of what you're talking about is what I call access, access to insurance, access to transportation, access to communication, interpretation, communication access in the setting. A lot of that is about what happens in the clinical encounter, in the delivery or the provision of health care. And that's where most of the attention is focused when you think about what the stories about health are in the media. And yet, I know our viewers don't have our picture, but there's a picture I use whenever I give a presentation, which is kind of frequently, that puts it in perspective. We use what's called a social determinants of health frame in the work we do. And really, it's about the environments where we live, learn, work, and play. And healthcare services are a very small fraction of what contributes to our health. Our health is primarily determined by our education, by our income, as I mentioned. And healthcare services, depending on whose sort of framework or paradigm you're using, are only 10 to 20%.
Really? Wow, that's
determining
small.
Our health, yes. And so it's the environment, like, is our neighborhood walkable? Is it a food desert? Do we have grocery stores where we can buy fresh fruits and vegetables? Can we go out and walk because we feel safe or not? Is it, you know, sort of the bad suburban planning where there's no sidewalks and you can't get anywhere from anywhere? All those things are factors, and they may be more complicated in some of our poorer neighborhoods. You may also have issues of, as immigrants, you know, what's the environment, the social environment like? How welcoming is the community? So stress, you know, whether you feel, you know, we've had horrible instances recently where people write nasty messages on newcomers' walls.
Here in
Concord. And so that is all a determinant of people's health. And so in addition to trying to provide communication access in healthcare settings and talking about what happens in the provision of health, a lot of us who are partnering on this work now also think beyond the context of the healthcare setting and think about the social and community networks. There's an initiative called Welcoming New Hampshire that's getting off the ground that is something that's going on around the country that Kelly can speak to a little bit more eloquently than I. But also workforce diversity. So we talked about how the medical interpreters bridge the cultures. If you can have a provider such as myself who is bilingual, bicultural, you have what's called cultural concordance in a patient encounter that can help increase trust. It can help increase communication and satisfaction. There is some evidence it may increase quality. It's not universal. I don't want to stereotype. I might be more different from my patient than someone else. But it's a step. And so increasingly diversifying our health workforce is an important value. As children see faces that look like them, they can aspire to grow up and become a profession that maybe they might not have envisioned previously. And as people have better paying jobs that can then assure their future and their family's future, then their health is more assured because health is mostly determined by income and education.
So in addition to all the issues coming up in that healthcare setting and the stories that Dr. Mahon told us, bigger picture than that. All right. Thank you all very much for coming in. Kelly LaFlamme, it was nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Kelly LaFlamme, Program Director at the Endowment for Health. She manages initiatives on social and cultural barriers to health. And Dr. Trinidad Tellez, good to see you too. Thank you for being here. Dr. Trinidad Tellez, Director of the Office of Minority Health and Refugee Affairs at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Paula Mahon, thanks for taking time out from your practice to be with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Paula Mahon practices at the Westside Neighborhood Health Center at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our series on New Hampshire's immigration story is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our interns are Ryan Lassard and Karen Goll. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.